I think all of us can agree that getting older means changes are in store. While I may look like I'm in my 20s, you guys know the truth and my body is changing and I'm always learning what it wants. Whether you're in your early 20s and experiencing changes in your menstrual cycle, or your age is a little bit higher and you're nearing perimenopause or menopause, we should be talking about it. There shouldn't be any shame in looking for ways to support our body through changes and help ourselves through difficult times. Happy Mammoth, the company that created Hormone Harmony, is dedicated to making women's lives easier. And that means using only science-backed ingredients that have been proven to work for women. They make no compromise when it comes to quality, and it shows. Hormone Harmony isn't just for menopause. Any woman with symptoms of hormonal imbalances can take it. It's perfect for symptoms that put a woman's life on hold. Things like hot flashes and night sweats, racing thoughts and low moods, poor sleep and feeling tired all the time, and occasional bloating and gas. And the biggest benefit? Women say, feeling like myself again. That's what women mention over and over in Hormone Harmony reviews. For a limited time, you can get 15% off your entire first order at happymammoth.com just by using the code RAIN at checkout. That's happymammoth.com and use the code RAIN for 15% off today.
This is Murder in the Rain, where each week Emily Rowney, Alicia Holland, and Josh McCullough tell true crime stories of the Pacific Northwest. Murder in the Rain contains graphic content. Listener discretion is advised. Last week, I told the stories of 8 young Black women trafficked into sex work. All had been murdered in and around North Portland. These cases were presented to the Green River Task Force when no suspects emerged during initial investigations. It was found that none of the murders were connected to Gary Ridgway. Years later, the state would claim 5 of the women were connected to the same culprit. Today, I'll detail how police eventually tracked down and arrested a man for 4 of the murders, employed flimsy at best DNA evidence, and how the law presented a generous and underhanded plea deal, which left some wondering if the closure of 4 unsolved cold cases was motivated by a district attorney's election rather than justice. The Green River Task Force wasn't able to make any connection between the Portland victims and the yet-to-be-known Green River killer. After decades of silence and freezer-burned level coldness, it seemed like the lives of Essie, Tanya, Angela, Latanja, and Luana would continue to be forgotten, and the person or persons responsible for their murders would live their lives without consequences. Loved ones of those victims held out hope that the killer would one day be caught, but with each passing day, week, year, it seemed less and less likely that they would ever see justice. In 1983, there were only whispers surrounding the possible future use of something referred to as DNA, but the technology was eons away from being usable. As disappointing as some of the actions and statements made by detectives had been, they did get the littlest good detective bell here. Even though DNA testing did not yet exist, they gathered all the evidence they could at the multiple scenes. Much of that evidence contained DNA. In early October 2015, detectives were provided a search warrant. There was a convicted felon who had not been arrested since a law changed where he would have been required to provide a DNA sample after being convicted. Though the man had been in and out of court since 1978, he had not been on police radar for these cases. But something in the investigation had changed, and they wanted his DNA. The detectives went to the man's home, and he freely gave his blood and saliva sample. A week later, at 9:15 a.m. on a Thursday morning, police came to the man's home again. This time, they did not want his DNA. They wanted to bring him in for questioning. The DNA results were back, and they had concerns surrounding at least one of the murders. During the questioning slash interrogation, it was reported the man confessed to the murders and he was swiftly indicted for the murders of Essie Jackson in March 1983, Tanya Harry in July 1983, Angela Anderson in September of 1983, and LaTanja Watts in March of 1987. At the time, there were no charges brought for the death of Luana Triplett, who had been found in the bushes under the same pedestrian overpass as LaTanja's body. When the man was arrested, the police used the media coverage to point out the dangers of sex trafficking, a bit of a see what happens when you work the streets, ladies. Detectives had seen a pattern in these deaths. Young, black women who had been participating in sex work who were then sexually assaulted, found in North Portland, and had been strangled. Officials may have hoped that they were one-offs or related to a different active killer. There was no telling if the pattern was ever put together by investigators or if they did anything to warn the women and children who fit the description of being possible victims. Because of the sexual assault and strangulations, each death earned 3 charges. Additional charges were added, and I can only guess that they were possibly related to Angela having been only 14, and it was a total of 15 charges. 15 charges, including multiple counts of aggravated murder, was a shock to the residents of the apartment complex on Northeast 13th Avenue. The man who had lived on the second floor apartment for the previous 13 years before being taken away in handcuffs was Homer Jackson III, or 5th, depending on what article you were reading. At the time of his arrest, Homer was 55 years old. Few in the neighborhood knew him. He lived off disability and kept to himself. He was most often seen leaving for a doctor's appointment with family members. He was decent-looking, a light-skinned black man with short, dark hair, with light gray-green eyes that on occasion were adorned with Jeffrey Dahmer-inspired glasses that sat over a crooked smile. Homer's disability was related to him suffering from paranoid schizophrenia since at least 2011, or that was when he was diagnosed and given medication. He had physical ailments such as diabetes. He also developed congenital heart failure and long-term memory issues after being shot by his brother-in-law, which led to the loss of a lung in the mid-1980s. Even though Homer couldn't work and did not have a full-time job, he helped his grandmother give out food and clothing to those who needed it at Life Center. It was located on Northeast MLK Boulevard, placing him close to the murder sites. During questioning, Homer admitted to having used crack cocaine in the past and frequently utilizing sex workers. He was a John about every other week or so and had a preference for black girls, which all of the victims in this case had been. He struggled with depression, he drank, he used meth and weed in the 80s, which had led to him blacking out, and it certainly didn't help with his memory issues. The police knew of Homer. He had been a regular since the late 70s. I couldn't find his earlier arrests, which would later be referenced when speaking with the police, but here's a list of the times he encountered the legal system and was not noted as being a possible suspect or taken off the streets to get help. Going back to 1983, the year of the first murders, Homer was charged with burglary in the second degree. He pled not guilty, but the judge disagreed. Homer served a year in jail and was given 5 years probation. The following year, he was arrested for criminal mischief in the first degree. This case was listed as a closed case and that he wouldn't be given more jail time even though he was on probation. This is believed to have been the incident brought up during the interrogation in which a starving Homer admitted to breaking into a fast food restaurant looking for something to eat. The year after that, he was busted driving with a suspended license, which he pled guilty to, violating probation and driving. He was fined $300, which was suspended. In 1987, while still on probation, he was convicted of having an open container in his car. His license was revoked and he was fined $42. The next year, it was failure to obey a traffic control device. He was convicted and fined $26. That same year, he was once again caught driving on a suspended license. He pled guilty, and since I'm not a lawyer, I couldn't decipher if the document said that maybe perhaps the probation was extended, but it didn't appear he had any jail time added. In 88, a $36 fine came from driving without insurance. 91, he was convicted for a fish and game violation. This was one of many court appearances Homer dipped on and had a bench warrant issued for. The fines for the fishing without a license charge was waived. In September of 1993, the time of the second set of murders, Homer was once again caught driving without a license and for a violation of a basic rule. Again, he failed to appear, twice, and there didn't seem to be any fines or sentences given. In 96, Homer was brought to court by Emerald City Volleyball for not paying a bill. He was charged $36.30. November of 98, it was a ticket for a failure to use his seatbelt and for having a headlight out. Back to civil court in 99 for non-payment on a contract with Midtown Credit, he was ordered to pay $42. That was followed in 2001 with a breach of contract with an insurance company that was closed. He owed nothing. In 2006, it was a landlord-tenant issue. He was fined $59. 2000 was another traffic violation and failure to appear. He was fined $175. In August of 2001, Homer was charged with second-degree criminal mischief. At the time, it appears he had a no-contact order against him for someone listed as Vic Jesse Sanchez or victim Jesse Sanchez. Homer was convicted. I didn't see anything resembling a sentence in that case, though, nor was I able to learn about what might have transpired with this Jesse person leading to that restrictive order. 2003 saw Homer receiving another Fish and Game fine when he was caught fishing without a license. He did not show up to court and was fined $80. In February 2005, there were two charges for DUII and one count of reckless driving. One of the DUII charges was dismissed, the other and the reckless driving he was convicted on. The diversion fee was waived and he was ordered to attend a diversion program for 1 year and another class for 18 months. He was also given 18 months probation. He failed to appear at the arraignment. In the end, he might have owed up to $1,632, but it looks like the fees and fines were waived. The real red flag surrounding Homer came in 2006 and 2007. In early 2006, Homer was suffering from hallucinations brought on by his schizophrenia. Police were called when Homer fired a rifle through his balcony door as he felt intruders were breaking into his home. It didn't matter that no person could have physically climbed up to his balcony. When police arrived, he was arrested and charged with unlawful use of a weapon and for discharging a firearm in the city, a Class C felony and misdemeanor, respectively. Waiting to be taken away, Homer asked the officer he was speaking with about the woman who was standing by his side. No one was there. Homer was convicted for the misdemeanor. Charges were deferred. The judge ordered him to take his medication as it was prescribed, and he would be given 12 months probation, 96 hours of community service, and he would have to forfeit his weapon. His fines were waived, and he was hospitalized. In 2007, it was Homer who was calling the police several times. He informed the dispatcher he felt people were trying to break into his house again, but he was armed with a gun. Learning more about the situation and Homer, it was decided he was suffering from hallucinations. When police arrived, they found that Homer's gun was a long stick. Officers pulled their guns and safely took Homer into custody. Once again, he was hospitalized. Things were quiet until 2009 when another civil case was dismissed. The next year, a man named Steve sued Homer for $1,241.04. It's unclear for what loan or lien he was suing for. Just a few days after his arrest in 2015, newspapers ran the story of Homer Jackson confessing to the murders. Investigators were still being vague when sharing details. Statements were generalized. They had questioned people in the neighborhood, ran DNA, and were able to piece it all together. Homer was their guy. Homer's lawyers entered a plea of not guilty in his first court appearance. When he was initially arrested, it was to question him about a single murder, Angela Anderson's. Once he was in custody, it was reported Homer spilled the beans about all of the murders and his involvement in them. Detectives were armed with DNA, witness statements, fingerprints, Homer's criminal history, and now a confession. It was a slam dunk case, right? Only 6 months after his initial court appearance, Homer's defense team started the process of having the charges dropped. They claimed that while Homer did confess to killing 14-year-old Angela Anderson back in 1983, the detectives added into the report that Homer confessed to all of the killings. This supposed confession was thrown in as evidence for the grand jury. So let's take a look at the evidence the state was using to back the charges. At the scene in Overlook Park where Essie Jackson had been found, there was no evidence that connected Homer. Both being Jackson, it's important to note that there was no relation between the two. Essie's nail scrapings and the testing of a bloodstain found on her pants did not match Homer nor anyone else in the system. There was no evidence showing the two had ever encountered one another. The two hairs on her body were 6 inches long and belonged to a Caucasian person. His lawyers argued that there was no witness tying Homer to the area at the time, nor was there any physical evidence linking him. The state claimed that while Homer was speaking with police, he said he remembered the Overlook Park homicide. They showed him photos of the scene and asked questions, which he struggled to answer. He said he never saw her face and couldn't recall how he got her body down the hill. Tanya Harry had been found in July 1983 in the West Delta Park Slough. The belt that had been recovered from the scene was tested. It appeared to have been used in an attempt to strangle Tanya, but it either didn't work so the killer gave up and used their hands, or Tanya had a reaction to the drugs in her system while she was being strangled. DNA from Homer Jackson was recovered from the belt, which had been broken into three pieces. Perhaps its fragility was what stopped the killer from using it to strangle Tanya. Homer's lawyer pointed out there was DNA from at least three other people on the same belt, so Homer's being there was moot. Connor Huseby, the lawyer for Homer, went on to say about the belt that, quote, "The crime lab was unable to match Mr. Jackson to the belt. Instead, they were simply unable to exclude Mr. Jackson as a contributor to the belt." Other items recovered from the scene were paper towels saturated with semen, cigarettes, and a hair on her clothes. The hair and semen were from the same male and were not a match to Homer. Homer's DNA was not located on any pieces of evidence besides the non-exclusion from the belt. However, three other males had DNA under Tanya's nails. LaTanja Watts was killed around March 18, 1987. DNA of Homer's had been located under her fingernails. No full profile could be made from the DNA recovered from the scarf wrapped around her neck, and it contained samples from at least five males. There were fingerprints on the plastic wrapped around her body, but they were not a match for Homer. The state's argument was that there had been a DNA match for LaTanja's nails that also matched a cigarette that was recovered from a different crime scene, that being the murder of 14-year-old Angela Anderson. I mentioned earlier how at the empty house where Angela's body was found, there was a fingerprint on a cabinet and multiple cigarettes. The fingerprints from the door and the DNA on the cigarette were a match to each other. To counter, it was pointed that there was DNA on the cord around Angela's neck, and it did not match Homer. Neither did the fingerprints on the window, which had its cord used to murder her. During questioning with police, Homer said he couldn't remember, but when it came to killing Angela, he had done so with, quote, maybe a knife. Later in the conversation, he would say that he had met Angela in a park where he made a plan to meet with her at the empty house to engage in a sexual act. Then, opposite of his maybe I stabbed her story, he said, quote, I know I did kill her. I think I strangled her. I think that's what I did. Homer shocked investigators when he confessed to being more prolific than they had originally thought, saying, quote, she could be number 25 for all I know. I don't know. You know, I don't know who was first, second, third. You know, I don't know. I wasn't keeping no scorecard. You know, I don't know who was first, who was last, who was second, who was fifth. A complaint from the defense was that the police had not done their due diligence of following up on every lead during the investigation. It was revealed that a man had called 911 on November 19, 1983, and he told the dispatcher about 3 months earlier, this was 4 months after Tanya's murder, he had killed a girl in a park. The information was forwarded to the appropriate detectives, but they either never bothered following up or they were unable to track that person down. Not to play devil's advocate, but that one is really concerning. It's not like these murders were on the front page of the paper every day or ever. So it does seem like that could have been the killer who called in. Not like there aren't enough murders that someone could call and say that at any time and it would probably apply, but that's a big red flag for me. It was around this same time in spring of 2016 that the circumstances surrounding the police's initial interrogation of Homer were released. It was reported the detectives had used what is referred to as the Reed technique. The Reed technique was developed by former Chicago cop and polygraph expert John E. Reed. Using a multiple-step system, he was able to get a confession from a man for the murder of his wife, and the technique was celebrated. The man recanted his confession but was sentenced to life anyway. He was serving that life sentence until the actual perpetrator was caught and the man sued the state of Nebraska. John created the system in the 50s, and within 20 years, it was being utilized nationally. Proven flaws be damned. The Reed technique consists of three phases and nine steps. The first phase is to complete fact analysis, that is followed by a behavior analysis interview. The third and final phase is the nine steps. Those steps, which have been established through the technique and court decisions, are presented in a way that allows officers to lie to the suspect about guilt or evidence in an effort to elicit information or a confession. Step one is a positive confrontation in which an officer or detective can inform the suspect that evidence has led them to being brought in, then allowing them to confess or explain the situation. The second step is to use that information to try and pin the offense on someone else or to create a theme surrounding the situation. The officer can kind of make up reasons why this person would do such a thing. The third step is to minimize how much the person being questioned denies the accusations. Similarly, the fourth step is to minimize objections. As the person is explaining why they couldn't have or didn't do something, the officer can twist the information into the reason why they did do it. Fifth is to maintain the interviewee's attention, basically checking in to make sure they're staying on track with the officer and their accusations. The sixth step is to manage the suspect's mood. By now, it's expected that they're going to be listening to the interrogator and possibly becoming emotional. It is suggested if the interviewee begins to cry at the accusations, the investigator should then imply their guilt further. Seventh is to create an opportunity to confess by giving options, like either an owl came into your house, attacked your wife on the head as she was at the top of the stairs and she fell to her death, or you, the husband who was getting new life insurance, murdered her. Because one sounds more legitimate, it creates the illusion that the person should confess. Once they've agreed to the scenario or confessed outright, step eight is to have them repeat the confession to others and to give more detail, ending with step nine, which is to document the confession via a written statement, audio, or video recording. In Homer's case, the detective showed him photos of three of the victims. Homer did not know them. The detectives informed him they had all been murdered and his DNA was at the scene. They knew he had done it. They just needed to know why. He responded with, "Well, I don't know how they occurred, because I'm not a killer." The detectives took a break before starting back up with the "We have your DNA" conversation. They accused Homer of re-victimizing the families by not being honest. He said, "I don't remember killing nobody, especially them." They called him a liar. While on a smoke break, the attending officer started nagging Homer to just confess. Back in the room, Homer was shown the photos again. With another glance, he claimed to recognize Angela Anderson, the 14-year-old victim. This led to his confession of killing her, again, possibly by stabbing, and the detectives pushed for additional confessions. Detectives said if he told the truth, he could retain some semblance of control over his life and drive the proverbial train, but if he continued to lie, he'd be run over by it. Choo-choo. Asked about his personal life, Homer was unable to give a clear answer about the dates and lengths of his marriages. He also couldn't tell how old his mother should have been when he was asking for her, saying she should be about 60 years old. Homer was 55. Over and over again, Homer said he knew nothing of the murders. It wasn't until he was told Angela couldn't have been his first victim that he started to talk about a scorecard. For the state, Homer's admission of not keeping track and not remembering anything about the other cases was actually proof that he had committed the murders. Not that he was a mentally unwell man with memory issues caused by years of drug and alcohol abuse. For them, his memory was unretrievable because there had simply been so many victims over the years. The interrogation ended with this exchange. Detective: Homer, I want to ask you kind of a very direct question before we put you on the phone with your mom and your sister. Homer: Uh-huh. Detective: Can I go to the families of the woman at Overlook, which was S.E. Jackson, the woman by the slough, Tanya Harry, and the woman by the bridge, Latanja Watts, and tell them that you've acknowledged that you're responsible for their loved one's death, you just don't remember it? Homer: No, no, no. Detective: Why? Homer: Because I'm still not certain, and that would be so sounding like I am certain, and I did do it, and I'm not certain. I'm just saying if I did do something, this would be what it would be like, or this is how it would be. Not that I did do it, actually did do it. Detective: Right. Homer: So, no, I can't. No, I can't have that one. No. Homer then called his sister to let her know where he'd been. She asked if he had been getting sleep or if he was hallucinating. He said he had slept a little bit. She was shocked that he had been talking to the police for 2 days, confessing to murders, and waived his right to a lawyer. The interrogation and smoke breaks were all recorded. You can find the document with all of the mundane details by Googling Oregon Supreme Court versus Homer Jackson. The 2018 document is the one regarding the interview. Upsettingly, on the second day of questioning, detectives had a video from Angela's mother where she was thanking Homer for confessing. And I can't even imagine the call that they made. Hey, could you make a video for us? Getting her hopes up that they were in a questioning phase with her possible killer of her daughter. I think that's really, really sick. They also had a video of LaTanja Watts' son asking Homer to admit his guilt.
Oh, God.
This led to Homer's admission of, maybe I did it and I just don't remember. And I think that's so, to get those families' hopes up or to use them that way, oof, that made my stomach churn.
It's like they were trying anything.
Yeah. They know right there they don't really maybe have it. Yeah. Looking to move forward with prosecuting Homer Jackson for all four murders, the state had a confession for the murder of Angela, DNA and fingerprints of Homer at the scene, Homer's DNA on part of Tanya's belt, no DNA from Essie's scene, and some of Homer's DNA possibly under the nails of LaTanja Watts. He had confessed to the other murders after being provided crime scene photos. His defense lawyer moved to have the confession, which he felt was coerced from his client via the Reed technique, removed and the charges dropped. He knew the only way the grand jury had decided to move forward with charges was due to the confession, not the physical evidence. The battle against the confession went on for 2 years before winding up in front of the Oregon Supreme Court. You can read the court's scathing decision in full via that document. Some of the highlights they took issue with were the laws the officers broke regarding promises and threats made to Homer based on his confession, saying that if Homer confessed, everything would turn out best for everybody, that they were trying to save and help Homer by getting a confession, talking about the other active murder investigations and implying that they would be looking at him for those as well, that the jury would be given the evidence and if he couldn't explain it, or just said he couldn't remember, the jury would assume he was guilty, or that Homer would be viewed as a monster by the families of the victims, the jury, and the public unless he confessed, and that if he didn't, the detectives would do everything in their power to get him a harsher sentence. That last one is an especially big whoopsie. During an interrogation, the police are allowed to allude to things or, you know, like the Reed technique, but they aren't allowed to utilize that to say, if you just tell us now, we'll make sure you only serve a year.
Oh, yeah. They have no control over that.
Yeah. So that's a big no-no as far as what you're allowed to promise. But all of those things I just said were the big, like, can't do those things.
Is that anywhere near a civil rights violation?
Oh, that's a good question. I don't know civil rights enough to know, but I would say I wouldn't be shocked.
Sounds kind of like that to
me. Especially him being mentally impaired.
Oh, of course, yeah.
And dismissing a lawyer. And holding him for 2 days.
Yeah, a lot of the signs he's showing and the things he's saying would be very concerning to any third party who maybe saw what was going on.
Yeah.
The True Crime and Paranormal Podcast Festival is just around the corner. We'll be at the Denver Marriott Westminster July 12th through 14th, manning our booth, giving out stickers, selling merch, and facilitating a session on Sunday morning. There's still plenty of time to get tickets, and you can use our code RAIN15 to get 15% off your purchase. The True Crime Paranormal Podcast Festival is a great opportunity to connect with your favorite podcasts, those impacted by the cases we discuss, and other true crime fans and creators. We had a blast last year, and we cannot wait for this year. We think you will have a great time, too, so join us. You can get your tickets at truecrimepodcastfestival.com, and remember to use the code RAIN15 at checkout for 15% off. As the interrogation went on, detectives said that this was Homer's one chance to confess, and if he concocted a story later, no one would believe him. The interrogation would go on as long as needed, and they would work together to get the facts straight, and until then, he would not be permitted to speak with his family. The state Supreme Court decided the trial court was right to suppress both the supposed confession made during the interrogation and the conversation Homer had with his sister during that same time, while they were on the phone, and he repeated the "I killed the one girl but don't know about the others" story.
The state said during the initial charges they would bring in Homer's previous victims. Homer had been arrested for suspicion of rape in the late 80s. I could find zero documentation regarding this arrest, but the charge was dropped. However, the state threatened to bring in three former sex workers whom all claimed they had been attacked and strangled by Homer during the time frame of the original murders. There was no further mention of those reported victims anywhere else in publicly accessible documents. Given everything we're about to learn, I would be surprised if these women were real. Not that Homer wasn't capable or to dismiss anyone's claims of abuse, but what are the odds that in 2015, women who had been sex workers well over 30 years prior would not only still be in town, but they'd be easy to track down, they would be willing to testify and work with the police? To never see their names or the accusations listed again has me a little concerned. Without that confession, the evidence that did exist against Homer Jackson was weak at best, but the state wasn't willing to let him go. So in May of 2019, new charges arose. The murder of Essie Jackson was dropped from the list, and Luana Triplett was added. This late addition might have been due to advancements in testing or getting around to doing so. You may recall Luana had been attacked more brutally than the other victims. Investigators were able to retrieve DNA from the bite mark on her nipple. Running it against Homer's, it was found to be a match. Sort of. The odds of that DNA being Homer's was 1 in 3,896. The population of Portland at that time was 493,754. So Homer and 126 other men in the area would have been a match. Getting ready for trial, the state was going to use evidence from the other crimes as evidence for each crime, saying if his DNA was here where Angela was murdered and it was maybe here where Tanya was killed, that proves that he was at both scenes and that he has a pattern of violent behavior. That cross-admission was opposed by the defense, leading to a three-day hearing just to decide if the other acts evidence could stand. The state fought back, bringing in an expert to say, not only are the odds of having your DNA at a murder scene where a sex worker has been killed extremely rare, but the odds of having your DNA at four different murder scenes was near impossible. But with the numbers they had surrounding the DNA and the other DNA at each scene, was that so improbable? The motion to allow cross-admittance was denied, and each murder would have to be proven with its own evidence. Does that make sense of what they were trying to do? Basically, the state was trying to say, let us show everything to say, sort of a match here, sort of a match here, well, sort of a match here. So it looks really bad to say partial DNA is at four scenes. So, of course, he killed Angela because the DNA was also here. And the defense was like,
A lot of sort ofs don't make a match.
But to the average person, if you're hearing some of his DNA might be in that many crime scenes,
right,
I guess that would kind of sway.
If you just hear man's DNA found at four crime scenes, you'd go.
But what I heard more earlier was that there was a potentially other people's DNA.
Right.
And that captured my attention more than partial
exactly.
DNA.
Exactly. In 2021, the court decided that the existence of Homer's DNA at multiple crime scenes was more than a coincidence. To prove he was committing the murders, the state would need to present a better explanation than Homer was the common link. For example, the court said that Homer had the unusual tendency to be present for the violent deaths of young black prostitutes over the time period in question. The state's plan at the trial was to go with a "what are the odds" theory. The court found that theory to be a bit too flimsy. After years of hearings, appeals, and objections, Homer Jackson was finally given a court date for early 2022. On Monday, January 31st, Homer went to court. This was not for trial, but for a plea deal, a deal referred to by one of the prosecutors as better than nothing. As part of the deal, Homer, now 62, pled guilty to four counts of negligent homicide regarding the deaths of Angela Anderson, Tanya Harry, LaTanja Watts, and Luana Triplett. Essie Jackson's murder was not included. This was done in part to protect the families of the victims. Four separate trials would have been torturous. As thoughtful as that might have been, the families didn't feel they had been thought of when the sentencing part of the deal was announced. Because the murders were committed so many years prior, and Homer was in such poor health and at an older age, He was sentenced to time served. As the trials were postponed and evidence was thrown out, Homer had remained behind bars. With their actions, the state basically said, "We think this guy is a prolific murderer, but we don't have enough evidence to go to trial. If we can get him to plead guilty, we can close 4 cases and send him on his way." After 6 years and 3 months, Homer Jackson was freed. Recently outed DA Mike Schmidt's office said that the decision was made because of Homer's deteriorating health, and though in his confession they fought so hard to use, he admitted to possibly killing up to 25 women. He had not, in their eyes, committed any murders since the early 90s, so he was not a threat to the community. Before Homer could go, he would have to sit through victim impact statements by loved ones of the victims. One of the people who spoke was Angela Anderson's sister, Dondra. Emotionally, she held up a photo of Angela, who had only been 14. Dondra was 8 when her sister was killed. Referencing the photo, Dondra said, "This is all I have left of my sister. I know she loved me. Nobody can take that from me." Dondra gave more details of Angela's life than any of the media coverage. She talked about Angela's love of bright colors and drawing, that she was caring and compassionate. Dondra spoke of the scar she has from where a dog bit her when she was little. Her big sister Angela came running to her side and kissed it better. That scar is a reminder of her sister's love. Mary, Angela's mother, also spoke. She asked that Homer's chair be moved so she could look directly at him. Staring Homer down, Mary said, "How can you murder a 14-year-old? How can you murder a 19-year-old? You left Angela in that house to just be rotted away like she was nothing. I don't look at you as a man. You are Satan's son. You don't deserve to be out." After being directed to look at the judge to make more comments, Mary was done and went back to her seat, saying something about Homer being a serial killer under her breath. A man named Michael spoke for Tanya Harry's family. His statement read, "For exactly 38 years, 6 months, and 22 days, our family has been waiting for Tanya's murder to be solved." He talked about how, even though Tanya was a gentle soul, she wound up in an abusive relationship after she graduated high school. That boyfriend then became her trafficker. Michael said, "Although we do not deem this as justice, we will allow closure and the opportunity to start the healing process. We're not comfortable with the idea of Homer Jackson being released to the unsuspecting public. We are fearful that more families will have a loved one taken from them by this murderer." Rachel, Luana Triplett's cousin, spoke as well, saying, "Why would you take somebody's life? This is a picture I want everyone to see. No matter if she's a prostitute or not, she still was a sister, a daughter, a cousin, somebody that we loved and belonged to us." As she spoke, she held up her cell phone. On the screen was a photo of Luana. It appears to be a cropped photo from Olin Mills or JCPenney, a nice classic family photo. Luana is in a beige suit. On our blog, you'll find that photo and photos of everyone else involved. The cropped photo on Rachel's phone is the only photo available of Luana. Speaking to Maxine Bernstein with The Oregonian about the sentence, Rachel said, "It's not fair at all. He took 4 people's lives. I don't feel like it's a win today. It feels like a slap in the face. As long as I'm breathing, I'm going to keep my sister's name alive." Almost exactly 1 year ago, and a year and a half after his release, on July 18th, 2023, Homer Jackson's sister went to his home to check on him. His health had been failing, and he was down to only 75 pounds. When his sister arrived, Homer was unresponsive, and she called for help. CPR attempts were made, but Homer Lee Jackson III was pronounced dead at 63 years old. It's believed his cause of death was related to his health issues and or natural causes. When I started this case, it seemed obvious on the surface that the outcome was outrageous. For the families and those who felt Homer Jackson was the perpetrator, I'm glad that they were able to get something resembling answers or closure or justice. I'm also heartbroken for them, as 6.5 years is a joke when it comes to the lives of 2 young women and 2 teenagers. That being said, and I want to be very careful with my wording because I don't want anything to be taken away from those who feel Homer was the guy. My entire perception of this case changed as I started going through the appeals. What this looks like to me is that D.A. Schmidt was going to be up for re-election in a year, and he wanted to be able to boast that his team closed at least 4 cold cases. The outcome angers me for everyone. When I think of Homer, it's hard for me to see anyone but Brendan Dassey from Making a Murderer. Granted, Homer was an adult and he made plenty of poor choices and could have very well played a part in these girls being harmed. But when you hear about his physical and mental health issues, some natural, some brought on by drug use, it seems pretty clear that he wasn't of a sound mind during the time of the murders or the interrogation. Even when he admitted to the murder of Angela, he was wrong about her cause of death. Staying on Angela, there was DNA on the cord that killed her, yet that person has not been found. If Homer had been involved or not, there was at least one other person who was there who strangled that child, and they have not been brought to justice. The desperation to close these cases, yet letting this supposed monster roam free, tells me that the state knew that they did not have the evidence to convict. They were happy just to take a win for their own sake. As for the other people who had DNA at the scenes, like whomever's semen was left with Tanya, where are they? Are DNA tests still being run, or did the plea deal close the case and these people are getting away with witnessing, participating in, or committing a murder? In the end, I feel most angry for the families, because these girls were dismissed as black prostitutes. Their cases were never given a fair chance. Then the system found a vulnerable, though not innocent, black man who fit enough of their criteria to hold him responsible. The prosecution then sold these families on the idea that it was, beyond a doubt, Homer who had done so much damage. But they knew they didn't have enough evidence to go to trial to get him convicted beyond a reasonable doubt. So it feels like the family's emotions were used to confirm to the public that, yes, Homer Jackson was the perpetrator. When I started writing the story, it was called Satan's Son. When I started writing the story, I called it Satan's Son, after the words of Mary, Angela's mother. But now I've added a question mark. There is plenty of work that could still be done to bring these families and victims justice. S.E. Jackson's case is still unsolved. There were men, or perhaps a different serial killer, who was present and left DNA at all of the scenes. I just hope that tests continue to be run and that Homer is either confirmed to be the killer or the real killers can be brought in to serve some real time.
That one's hard.
It's
interesting because if you put yourself as a jury member and you're presented with that, there is reasonable doubt.
Yes.
Definitely a lot of reasonable doubt. I just, when I listen to these types of cases, I always have a theory and I don't have one because of all the other DNA. It's so tricky.
I'll tell you something I had not really considered because I always took the dismissal of sex workers as, oh, no one's looking for them or no one care, you know, what the police perceive or why the cases aren't taken seriously. And I never thought about the difficulty of the DNA. That they're that much easier of a target because I can
true.
Just go to court and say, well, five other guys had DNA.
Well, and how long, I don't remember how long that DNA, I think it's like 3 days will sit in your body.
Yeah, they did say they had on one of the cases, and I don't remember who it was, they did at least have a time. I think they said within 5 hours, Homer had been, or the DNA that was closest match to him, it had been 5 hours.
Right, but I'm saying if you find all that other DNA, it could have been their days and...
I don't even know how they got started with him. Because if you have someone who is murdered and they're a sex worker and someone has left their semen in a paper towel next to them, I find it hard to believe that that person was not the most recent person with her to harm her.
Yeah, I would have wanted to know who that was.
So right away, as a prosecutor, I'm like, well, why are we going after this guy with
right there is the reasonable
partial...
doubt.
Yeah, exactly. Why are we going after this guy with a partial match when we have a cigarette and semen that match?
Yeah, it's hard. That's a hard one. It feels like one of those cases where they picked their suspect.
Yes.
And they're just going to do it till they got him, you know?
Yeah. I think they probably, because they picked him out, as someone who had been convicted of felonies but hadn't given his DNA. So I'm sure they had a list of people, you know, of people they need to get DNA from eventually.
Now, on the other side of it, that belt, that was his DNA or was it partial?
Partial.
Yeah.
See, or I believe the belt was non-exclusionary.
See, that's really hard, too, because there is somebody out there that it's that close.
Yes.
Right? Yeah, I don't know. That's tricky. And I think you bring up a good point. Like, maybe this is why we see a lack of prosecution against people who commit crimes against sex workers.
Right. Because that
it's
would
hard.
Be very, you could say, your this is your semen. It matches your DNA. And go, well, yeah, but there's other DNA.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I saw her. We hooked up in the park and then I left.
Yeah, these are the types of cases that are very hard to win in court.
Yeah.
Obviously, you don't want to be the scapegoat either. And it's really unfair when someone is mentally unwell.
Right.
They're easier to manipulate in those, you know, he was at least when it comes to questioning his, he knows he, in the past, his stories didn't make sense.
Right.
Right. So he's talking to these police
and he
officers.
Did have that arrest. And to say that those charges were dropped, I don't think that means anything for the early 80s for a rape accusation yeah. against a sex worker.
Right.
Like,
he fit
of course,
bill.
He's not going to get charged. So it's very possible that he was harming people. And it's not
sure
take away to say he didn't
but did
do this.
He do these particular crimes?
It's
we
just
don't
really
know.
Hard when the people that are presenting him to you as this monster then turn around and let him have 6 years because it can't be both.
They just want to check it off a list.
That's very
they want
much
their
what
closure
it felt like.
Rates to be higher.
The more I was digging, the more gross it felt.
Yeah.
Because on one hand, it's, and now they won't care because he's dead, but on one hand, it's okay, then really prove it. Don't just pull this guy out of the woodwork and then go, this is our murderer. Really prove it so we can all go, wow, you guys did a great job and you figured this out and you solved this case. Amazing. Thank you for getting this monster off the street. Yeah, let him rot in prison.
This is also one of the reasons people have a hard time with the death penalty.
Right.
These are the types of cases that people would get tried for the death penalty. And in, you know, in yeah. a perfect storm, they yeah. go away forever and they may not have done it.
I think if he had been younger or healthier, he probably would have tried for more. But I don't know if they ever would have gone to trial. Because their asses would have been whooped.
Oh, yeah. Get a good defense lawyer.
Yeah. And he had a great defense team. And I believe they were all public defenders. And they were on top of it. They were like,
they saw
that's not happening.
Chance to shine.
Yeah. So, and again, my heart breaks the most for their families.
Yeah. Because they want someone to blame, obviously.
Right. And you, on one hand,
and who knows what they're being told.
Exactly. That's what it feels like to go in and be that angry. I get because you think this is the guy.
He admitted
I don't
it.
Know exactly. Oh, he's taken a plea deal.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if these families knew that there was not a DNA match.
I'm sure they learned at some point.
So I reached out to the journalist that spoke with them at the court. We've talked to them before, and I'm just trying to get a hold of family members because I'm just so curious what they did know. What were they presented with? Were they just told, hey, we got the guy and he's taken a deal?
Right. And what did they learn later? And do they still
exactly.
feel the same way?
Yeah.
Because people can change after learning information.
And I don't think they're wrong for feeling if he's the guy. That's what they've been presented with. And I don't want that to be taken away from them, you know, to say, oh, you guys can't be mad or how dare you talk to him that way in court when it probably was. No, if that's what you feel and that's the guy, then that's the guy. And you have something resembling an answer. It's more just I hope that they weren't manipulated into doing that. I hope that they were provided the right amount of information to feel like it was the person.
But what's so scary is that person could have been out there.
That's what
still,
I'm saying.
Right?
We have matching DNA. A 14-year-old girl is in an empty house and the cigarette and the fingerprint on the cabinet match Homer. Okay, so he was in that room and he said, we met up at the park to go to this house to hook up. Okay.
Did someone come in after?
But you have DNA matching on a window and on the cord around her neck and it doesn't match him?
Very odd indeed.
How is he the murderer then?
Here's a theory. What if they do their thing? He leaves. Someone's doing drugs or something. Another person comes in and sees a prime opportunity. Like anything
exactly.
could have happened with another set of DNA. It's
exactly.
very
or
odd.
Like we talked about last time, people know where those houses are.
Right. They said the traffic was heavy in them because they knew that's like a drug den
yeah.
slash
or sex workers.
Work.
Yeah. It's like that is known within those communities. Those places are known.
Yeah.
So for him to meet there, okay. I'm not saying he's a good guy. He was having sex with a 14-year-old
yeah,
girl.
Yeah,
like
absolutely.
He's not, I'm not forgiving him of his sins.
But you can go to prison for other crimes, not murdering someone
I just
you didn't
don't,
do.
Yeah, I just don't know how far those sins go. And when you have a paper towel of semen and you have
and
a cord around a neck
that
and those don't match him.
Just as plausible to what I just said. Like somebody,
yes.
like that is how out there this case is.
Yes.
Yikes.
Did the window and the cord have the same DNA as the material in the paper towels?
No, but the paper towel and I believe a cigarette butt at that same scene, which I believe was Tanya. And I'm sorry, there's so many.
So there's at least three additional people.
Oh, at least. I would not be surprised if all five victims were victims of different people.
What if he left and multiple people did it? Like, that's just
yes.
so horrifying.
Or what if he was there
while it happened?
Exactly.
Yeah. That's what I was
and
thinking.
Knowing how he is and drugs and alcohol, and this is the 80s when he was using meth and crack cocaine, maybe he's sitting there and it happens.
Or maybe he knows, was involved.
Exactly.
But wasn't the only one.
But there's just nothing sure enough to say
in court,
this is what
you
happened.
Could easily point your finger at that other person that you don't know who it is.
There are too many red flags and too much of a lack of evidence to feel like this was the guy. It feels like there are people
yeah.
who murdered these children and they have lived their life either continuing to harm people or just flat out getting away with it and living their life.
Absolutely. I definitely do not feel good about him being the person they say yeah. killed all these people.
You might recall for a while I was doing COVID commercials to help small businesses. Well, months ago, Wendy from Sapphire Frog Soap reached out, and I am just now getting around to sharing her information. Thank you for being so patient, Wendy. At sapphirefrogsoap.com, you'll find a variety of artisanal skincare products geared toward giving you the best skin possible. Every product is handcrafted and never contains harsh chemicals. Sapphire Frog Soap has, yes, soap with scents like eucalyptus spearmint, vanilla sandalwood, and fireside cowboy. But they also have body butters, shower steamers, a personal favorite of mine, deodorant, and lip balm. All of that sounds amazing, I know, but here's the best part. As a survivor of domestic violence, Wendy, the owner, has made it her life's passion and company goal to help as many people as she can who have been in her situation. For each purchase, a portion of sales is donated to a local domestic violence shelter. By purchasing Sapphire Frog soaps and other body products, you will also be helping support women and children, and men too, to get out of potentially life-threatening and dangerous situations. So visit sapphirefrogsoap.com today and get to smelling good while doing good. Sapphire Frog Soap.
They're so cool, they have unscented body butter
yeah,
for me.
That's right, for sensitive skin.
It's a cute logo they have there, and their products look delicious.
I would like to sniff the vanilla sandalwood, two of my favorite
sniff
scents.
Sniff my vanilla sandalwood.
That he felt people were trying. The next year, a man named Steve Weiner.
It could be Weiner.
No.
I mean, it could be.
I won't let it be.
Okay.
I'm just going to say Steve, but I wanted to give you guys a wiener.
I'll take any wiener I can get.
Yeah, you guys love wieners. You're crazy for wieners. You're wiener nuts.
Ooh, so nuts I have wieners. A good TikTok video of a wiener. Let me pull it up real
Hello?
Quick. Like, I'm going to play.
Got my wieners.
And delicious boiled tube steaks.
Sick.
Tube steak boogie. You know that. Is that a ZZ Top song?
Not
tube
that I know
steak
of.
Boogie?
Mm-hmm.
You're making that up?
I don't think so. I think I've heard
Let
it
me
or
look.
Read it.
Let me check the little Spotify.
That is a ZZ Top song.
No. Is it?
Yeah.
Oh, my God.
Tube steak. Tube steak.
Well, here, have a listen.
Boogie.
Tube snake boogie.
They're just looking for some tush.
This won't load enough. Oh,
first
tube
of all,
snake boogie.
Yeah, it's tube snake boogie, but there is an artist called Tube Steak Jones.
Sounds like ZZ Top.
But we gotta be. I mean, they gotta be talking about the same thing.
Tube snake.
You got a
boogie.
Tube snake and a tube steak.
Ew, I'm getting grossed out.
Hot dog wieners. Can you go back and say hallucinations? Right. I want to know what's going on with Vic Sanchez. Who's that guy? He sounds cool.
Oh, Vic, like victim.
Oh, sorry, Vic.
Should I have clarified that?
Yeah, maybe.
Okay.
I thought his name was Vic as well.
Oh, sorry.
That was like DLR plates in Fargo.
Yeah.
For me. I was the one that didn't know it. And you're Marge. And you're like,
oh, I'm going to have to question your detective skills there, Lou. There were fingerprints. Hello. Hello. I have a question.
Fingerprints.
I'm so scared. Step one is a positive confrontation.
My favorite kind.
He's got hallucinations after that confrontation. It is suggested.
Who is the DA?
Mike Schmidt, who just got voted out.
Thanks, Mike.
Even though I did vote for him because I don't like the other guy, but you know, what are you going to do?
There are always those choices, right?
Yeah.
Turd and a turd or whatever. Yeah.
So where, what
barf
we're living
sandwich
in.
Or a shit shake.
And it felt horrible. No, just going home. Like I
it
couldn't.
Was a little rubbery sounding.
I went home.
Like a little bit of that.
Yeah, that's what
yeah,
happened.
Yeah, a little like a 1% of that.
I like this microphone so much. After years of hearings, appeals, and objections.
I object.
Excuse me. I object. Murder in the Rain is a Cascade Media production, written, hosted, and edited by Josh McCullough, Emily Rowney, and Alicia Holland. Feel free to email us at murderintherain@gmail.com or through our website, murderintherain.com. For as little as $1 a month, you can subscribe on Patreon to get exclusive access to ad-free and older episodes. For only $5, you can access Patreon-exclusive episodes and content. For more of us, be sure to follow on all the socials, listen to Josh and Alicia on their other show, Always Be My Sisters, and follow Emily on TikTok at @M_murderinTheRain. And suck my balls.